Hello and welcome to Story Radio, the podcast for readers, writers and lovers of literature everywhere. Today, we're doing something a bit different because we're actually going to be talking about my novel and Martin is going to be interviewing me. The novel is called The House of Dust and Shadows and it's being published by Rowan Prose Publishing. It's coming out on June the 16th.
Welcome, Tabitha. It's great to finally see this book.
Yes.
Which, I really enjoyed, and I think it's interesting to see where it's ended up after a bit of a journey.
Yes.
I think it must be about 7 or 8 years ago that I first read bits of this.
That's right, at the Creative Writing MA that we were both doing. So I actually quit my job to write this novel. Then shortly afterwards was diagnosed with cancer and carried on writing it while I was undergoing chemotherapy, which was a pretty weird experience. And I think maybe sort of, you know, explains some of the sort of darkness of the novel. And then I workshopped it at Birkbeck, as you know, and continued editing it afterwards, particularly I think with the London Lit Lab, of course, that I believe you were on as well. So yes, it's been a long time coming, and Rowan Prose Publishing picked it up during a pitch on then Twitter called Pit Dark, I think it's called, for dark fiction, and that's how the book has come to be. So it's very exciting.
Congratulations. It's a very intriguing blend of dark family secrets and the supernatural. Could you talk a little bit about the major themes you explore in the novel?
Yes, so just to sort of really briefly sum up the story, a famous painter dies and disinherits his three daughters, Lucia, Izzy and Sarah. And he leaves all the money instead to the family housekeeper, Mary. And so the daughters have to try and find out why. And in the process of all of this happening, a body is discovered in the lake of Blackthorn Manor, which is where the three sisters grew up. So in terms of themes, it's a story about family secrets and buried secrets and how they haunt families through the generations. I think that's the best way to sum it up. And there's a second theme in there, which is about female creativity and how it can be sort of trammelled and destroyed by the patriarchy, not to put too fine a point on it. That's another theme of the book, and I think those are the two most important themes.
Yeah, the father's not exactly a shining example of fatherhood, is he?
He's a terrible father. Yes, he is. Yeah. I mean, there are other men in the book with far more redeeming features. I think what I was trying to show in him is, you know, this figure that we're all quite familiar with. You know, take Picasso, the solitary genius who actually, during his life, was propped up by the invisible labour of loads of the women and men around them. And, you know, so in fact, what looks like solitary genius is actually often the result of privilege. And that's what I'm trying to show in the character of Robert Landemore, that, you know, he is, you know, he's a solitary genius because lots of other people work very hard to enable him to be.
Recurring element is the inventory of artworks in the manor house, and you include notional catalogue descriptions as headers of some of the chapters, and then there's a relation in those chapters to that description. Could you talk a little bit about how you use that device?
At the opening of each chapter, it will describe a painting or sometimes an artwork and occasionally a book as well. There are quite a few sort of quotes interspersed through the book from books from Robert Landemore's private library. So again, this is about messages, hidden messages in artworks and cultural messages that are passed down. And each opening to the chapter describes one of these artworks, and it will relate to the chapter that unfolds in some way, or it will relate to one of the other characters in the book. You will discover as it goes on that the catalogue entries are written by an art critic who appears in the book, and then they are used as part of an art exhibition at the end of the book, as a sort of ironic counterpoint to some of the artworks or remains of the artworks that are displayed in the final exhibition. So I'm sort of playing with the idea of exhibitions and also the idea of catalogues, specifically when someone dies, sometimes their possessions, things like artworks, will be catalogued, and then those will be, used as part of the estate. So that's the whole idea, that these are not just academic descriptions of the artworks, but they're also cataloguing them for value. Because I think one thing that I'm talking about in the book is how financial value of things kind of cheapens them as artworks, and how turning everything into currency devalues it.
Hmm. Were you inspired by any other books that use images that way?
Yes, Notes from an Exhibition by Patrick Gale, which I think I read sort of quite early on when I was writing it. I just thought, gosh, that's a fantastic idea. I've come across it used in a couple of other places since. And, and I think a lot of Gothic texts use, hidden books and secrets and paintings and those kind of things. So I wanted to have a bit of that sort of, intertextuality and playfulness in the book.
And did you actually have particular paintings, real world paintings, that inspired you for these descriptions? Or
most of them come from my imagination. There's one that is kind of a little bit inspired by a real painting, which is the boy with his dog, a young cavalier, I think it is. So I looked up that artist and found a sort of artwork that was kind of similar in style, and chose it as a model for my imaginary painting. The rest of them are all, imagined from different periods of time, apart from the Three Graces is obviously inspired by the famous Canova sculpture. And I chose that because, again, this sort of whole idea of female creativity, the muses were often shown as, kind of emblems of creativity. They were feminized, but they were also trivialized. So they were like the muses of elegance or grace or, good conversation and that kind of thing. And so I used that really just, as a kind of, again, a way to sort of show how art was so often told from a male point of view. But the other thing I liked was that they're three women dancing together, and I found that quite a sort of powerful kind of way of reimagining, my three sisters and the bonds between them, even though they fight all the time. So so that's a way of showing, of embodying that. And in the exhibition at the end, the statue's still standing, even though one of them's had its nose chipped off and the other one's lost a hand. They've survived. So, I like that idea.
Hmm. The time structure is quite complex. How did this evolve? And did you have any sort of resistance from the publishers at all to try and kind of make it more simple?
Strangely, I had no resistance from the publishers. I've had a lot of people telling me that it was overcomplicated since I did it. I wanted to get a sort of slightly hallucinatory quality to the writing, a sort of slightly kind of, something to make it kind of feel strange and a bit disorientating. And the other thing was that, I've lived quite a long time. When I look back on my memories, they're often quite fragmented. Some of them will have more sort of emotional weight than others. But I don't remember things in a very linear or structured way. And I wanted to convey a sort of kind of the unsettling quality of how things are as you remember them, as well as when you're experiencing them in real time. So I think it's a bit about kind of forcing the reader to to think and experience things as though they're kind of almost as though they're looking back on them as well as experiencing them in real time and trying to fit them together. It's like the same experience as, you know, trying to understand and create a narrative from a slightly fragmentary narrative. And so for me, that's part of the whole kind of gothic experience, is being disorientated, not knowing where you are, where's the room, open the door, what's behind the door. So I suppose I wanted to kind of replicate that somehow in the writing.
I remember reading quite a lot of stuff about how time worked in a narrative, and even in kind of what seems to be a straightforward linear narrative, often it's much more complex. Did it change a lot in terms of where you put the events in terms of the order of the novel?
I did make several changes. For example, I moved the discovery of the body forward to the beginning of the book and used it as a kind of almost like a prologue, so that because originally it opened with the second chapter, which was really a bit of a tribute to the opening of Rebecca. Eventually, I decided that it was actually more powerful if we have the body found at the very beginning, and then the rest of the book just unfolds through time and different perspectives to sort of show how the body came to be there and whose body it is.
The interplay between the three sisters is intriguing. How did their characters emerge in your mind as you kind of worked on the novel?
All three sisters have a different kind of art form that they're interested in. Lucia is a photographer. She's interested in light and shadow. And she sees everything very clearly. So her name means light, of course. And my idea for her is that although she's comes across as very rational, she's also one of the most loyal and kind of, protective of the three sisters. She looks after her younger sisters, but she can be quite sort of curt and aggressive as well when she's talking to other people. And then Izzy is kind of a performer, and she doesn't quite know who she is. She finds herself through being other people. And, she sort of lacks a sort of a centered self, I think. And so I tried to show her as a very sort of someone who experiences everything through sensation and touch and kind of, sensual experiences of different kinds. And then Sarah, who's the youngest, who's the main protagonist, she is... she's a writer, very verbal, but she's also, so she's a sort of associated with earth and kind of, grounded experiences. And she's also, she experiences things in a kind of more verbal way. So that's how I kind of, in my mind, how they were. And then, of course, the strange thing is as you start writing, characters develop and form more, and develop their own stories and backstories as you're writing. Mm. One thing I found strange is that Isabella, who I thought was the least sympathetic of the sisters, is actually the one who everyone preferred when we were workshopping the characters, which has surprised me.
Yeah, she's kind of quite a lot of go about her. So she's,
yes.
Yeah, there's kind of always nice to have someone who breaks the rules.
Yes, she's totally a rule breaker and doesn't listen to other people's strictures on her behaviour. She just does her own thing, which I think is very quite empowering, really.
Mm. Were there any techniques like sort of writing biographies and so on for the characters that you followed in their creation?
I find writing those little character kind of bios a bit, I don't know why, I found it a little bit constricting, but I did try that, and I used a software called Scaffold to kind of create a sort of timeline of everyone and when they were born and, when events happened to them in the novel. But I think probably imagining them and imagining things through their point of view is probably the the most sort of the best way I've found of inhabiting the characters. I even dreamed I was one of them once, which is pretty amazing. Walked through the house. that was a really wonderful moment, actually inhabiting one of my characters.
Yeah, I've come across some mad questionnaires that you fill out for your character, like, you know, what's the first thing you see when you wake up from a terrifying dream and all these kind of things. It's I don't know. I think it can be kind of quite useful.
I did do one in a workshop once, mm-hmm. and it was quite useful. I think it must have been for Sarah, you know. And the other thing I did create a playlist for the book. So, you know, and I would listen to the playlist when I was writing.
Not individual playlists for the characters.
I did think about that, but, you know, because they're quite similar and, I mean, they're not that far apart in age, they would probably have had fairly similar tastes. Although, yes, thinking about it, I mean, yes, Lucia's the ex-goth, so she would have the most sort of, you know, alternative music taste of them, I suppose.
All right, you say that, because I'd have thought Izzy would probably have the most alternative taste. I noticed your mention of the colony rooms, and you've omitted to say anything about our live events there. How do the colony rooms feature in the novel?
Oh, right. So the colony rooms. So the colony rooms where we do our literary salons are and often, you know, record them. It's based on the original colony room in Soho. So so that was a famous club drinking den in Soho, which you know, people like Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon and co used to go to. It was run by Muriel Belcher and then by Ian Board, and I went there once with a friend of mine who introduced me. And Ian famously used to swear at people coming in, so I was very scared in case he did. But actually, he was very nice to me and asked me if I was a dancer, so that was all right.
He didn't make you dance.
He didn't make me dance, no. So Darren Caulfield, who's recreated the old colony room, which sort of disappeared in the middle of... Well, I forgot to say, yes, it was very popular with the young British artists as well, the YBAs. They all used to hang out there, along with various sort of music stars and so on. So Darren Caulfield's recreated the original Colony Room and as Colony Room Green. So it's essentially an artwork. It's a recreation of an existing bar, which is the one that features in my novel as the original bar. And Darren's recreated it all, you know, even down to the paint colour and some of the artworks that hang above the bar and all that kind of thing. It's actually an artwork in itself. You know, it's very, very, very meta.
Could you tell me a little bit about the title of the book, House of Dust and Shadows? How have you chose that?
Yes. So it's from a poem by Horace, and it's talking about the transience of earthly things. We are but dust and shadows. And the quote is actually on the front of the mosque in Brick Lane. I hope I pronounce it correctly, the Jame Masjid, or the Brick Lane Mosque, as I sort of think of it as. So this building was originally a Huguenot church, then it was briefly a chapel, then it became a synagogue, and now it's a mosque. And these words from Horace have been, you know, written on it all that time. And for me, I just love the idea that this building has, you know, persisted through these so many years and different kind of people inhabiting it, and yet it's kind of its message remains the same, yet its message is about transience. So and it's also a bit of a tribute to Brick Lane, which is where I grew up, and I still live in East London. It's an area that's very important to me. So that was the idea of the title. And obviously it's I love anything beginning, you know, the house of a lot of my favourite books, you know. Are about houses, haunted houses. And So for me, it just became, it came to my mind, and after that it couldn't be called anything else. I think it was originally going to be called Inheritance, and I went off that title because I read somewhere that it's the most commonly used short story title, along with The Gift. And I'd actually written a story called The Gift. And so when I sort of read that Inheritance was a very commonly used title, I was thinking, I think I'd better rethink that one.
Yeah. You didn't find anyone else had used it?
The House of Dust and Shadows. Yeah. No, there is a famous horror book called The House of Dust, which I did discover. No, it's The House of Leaves. The House of Leaves, sorry. And there are various books with similar titles, but none with my title. I hope and pray, anyway. I haven't seen any.
Yeah. It's difficult to find a unique title. Cause
it certainly is.
So many things are published now.
Too many books out there.
Especially with self-publishing as well.
Yes.
You play with a whole range of genres. This kind of family saga, bit of ghost story, bit of police procedure. Did you find yourself drawn into areas that you hadn't written in before, and how did you find those?
I read a lot of crime fiction, and you know, at one point I was toying with writing a crime novel, and I have in fact attempted crime novels before. I think, for example, Tana French is a crime novelist I really admire. And I think what appeals to me about them, again, it's the idea of there being a secret in the story and someone working to uncover that secret. And then the ghost is, for me, such a sort of important figure. So what the ghost is really, the ghost is someone who's coming back to tell something that's happened to them in whatever way they can. And I did a lot of reading while I was doing the MA. I read about Derrida and Spectres of Marx and some other theorists, Abrahams and Turok, and they talk about the suppression of secrets, cryptonomy, and how that sort of ricochets through generations. The idea of things that are unsayable and have to be expressed in a different way. And so for me, the ghost is, you know, it's a physical manifestation of something that can't be said. And that's how it's sort of expressed, you know. And I think that's maybe why I'm so obsessed with ghosts. I just love the idea that they are, you know, they manifest things that are hidden. And so I suppose really what it's about is family secrets, how they're hidden, how they're uncovered. What it does to families when things are concealed, and the novel sort of explores all those three strands and tries to sort of tie them together.
There's quite a lot buried away in there, isn't there?
Yes, there's a lot buried away in there.
Have you got a feeling for which direction you're heading in next?
I have. I've been working on a new novel, which I have to say has been much, much easier and faster to write than this one. I actually submitted it for the Michael Joseph Undiscovered Writers Prize. And although I made the long list, I didn't make the short list, but they did send me a commendation for my idea. And without going into too much detail, it's essentially a dark academia novel, which is another of my absolute favourite genres. And of course, inspired by reading The Secret History, like everyone else, I'm a huge admirer of Donna Tartt. And
do you explain dark academia?
Yes, of course. So, dark academia is essentially it's the idea of a group of scholars or people with scholarly interests and the pursuit of knowledge, which turns into either, you know, they might uncover dark forces, or they might, you know, simply through competition, or, you know, essentially it's when you pursue knowledge to the extent that it becomes damaging to other people around you, and The Secret History is about that. In my story, again, it's going to be feminist, and it's about goddesses, particularly goddesses that have been kind of forgotten or erased by later cultures. And so a group of students try to raise these goddesses, and with unexpected results.
The goddesses you've invented, or...
They're real. Well, when I say real goddesses, I mean that, you know, I've been, I sort of tried to resurrect my Anglo-Saxon language studies from university in order to read a bit of Anglo-Saxon. And I even studied runes briefly. And, you know, so I've been doing a lot of reading around the subject. It's going to be about goddesses who have not very much recorded about them. So I'm going to take a lot of license, obviously, with what we know, and you know, try and fill in the gaps imaginatively.
Let's hope they don't punish you.
Hmm?
Let's hope they don't punish you.
Yes, yes. No, I think they'll be pleased.
And what would you say you learned in the course of writing this book, The House of Dust and Shadows?
I think it's been a huge journey for me. Having a novel published was always my dream. I've discovered to be better at receiving criticism of my work and improving it and editing it. I've also, you know, discovered that, you know, if you have a vision and you want to create your own work of art in your own way, you will eventually find a receptive audience, you know. So you just have to... you have to bear in mind that it's a long and lonely process with lots and lots and lots of rejection emails and, yes, many, many, many ones of those, and persevere.
Hmm. In terms of the journey, the creative journey, how do you think you could have kind of made that quicker?
I am not sure. I discovered recently that I have ADHD, and I don't know whether that's affected the way I write, but I did start off as a short story writer, and I write a lot of short stories which require ferocious but also quite short bursts of concentration, which suits me because I can do hyper-focus. With a novel, there's a huge amount of plot detail and structure, and I do sometimes wonder if perhaps I might have approached it differently if I was more neurotypical. I don't know, but I also think that simply this particular novel had to be written in the way it was. I don't know why, but that it just seemed to be a long and painful and difficult process. I feel as though the new novel is going to be easier and quicker. I hope I'm right.
Mm. Well, thank you. Best of luck with it. I'm sure it'll do really well. Would you read an extract for us?
Yes.
Show the people that.
Yeah. So here's the book, House of Dust and Shadows, and it's coming out on June 16th. And the publisher is Rowan Prose Publishing. So I will read from the opening, I think, because it's... High summer had arrived at Blackthorn Manor. It was parched and hot, as the poisoned planet writhed uncomfortably under its stuffy carbon blanket. You wouldn't know, looking at the house, that things had changed much since the last century. You wouldn't necessarily sense the pesticides leaching out of the soil and into the water, or the lack of birdsong compared to 100 years ago, or mourn those creatures that have ceased to exist on the earth because of human greed. Innocent and wild, green and gold, the garden looked like Eden. Roses still in bloom arched their throats up to the sun. Wood pigeons strutted across the lawn. A lone bumblebee floated around the flower beds. Not many people came here. The property was still under lock and key. But there are ways to invade even secret, hidden places, and those in the know had started to explore. Teenage couples had broken into the gatehouse and left condoms and beer bottles there. And dog walkers and poachers explored the woods with impunity, ignoring the no trespassing signs. Now there were four young people laden down with various items, struggling across the lawn. They'd come from Thornby to film in front of the house and utilise the faded glamour of their location to the full. Their lead actress, Laura, was a friend who was studying drama while they were studying film, but her expressive features and luminous skin made her a natural in front of the camera. Everyone was in high spirits, although they were hot from the drive and the struggle over the fence and through the woods, where it was a difficult journey through the trees, including the stubborn blackthorns that had given the manor its name. Ethan, who was directing the shoot, carried the heavy cool box full of snacks and drinks. Alex had the suitcase full of props and clothes. Mariam, their makeup artist and another friend from college, had her own large silver case full of foundation, powders and sparkling glitter. And Laura carried Ethan's camera and kit. Ethan made it as far as the terrace, where he put the box down in a shady spot next to the wall. He wiped sweat from his face. The heat was so intense, it was quite fierce. "Let's stop here. I'm so hot," moaned Laura, piling her things next to the cool box and collapsing dramatically on the lawn. "Isn't this place amazing? I can't believe we just have it all to ourselves." Ethan took a few photos on his phone to share online, admiring the way Lara's limbs were elegantly arranged on the parched grass. He went over the planned shoot in his head. They had some props with them, fake flowers and a vase, a folding table and tablecloth, and he wanted to have Lara pose on the terrace. But their surroundings prompted other ideas as well. "Let's do the terrace scenes first, and then maybe we should try something by the lake and that little boathouse. That could look really good." "What should I wear?" asked Lara. Ethan thought for a while. He wanted Lara to wear something gauzy and floaty, something that summed up the beautiful and wealthy at play. Ethan wasn't one of them. He was from a council estate in Thornby, but he was one of those people whose certainty inspired others around them. "The white dress. I want her to look bleached out." Mariam got to work on Lara with her little brushes and pads. Lara waited patiently, perched now on the terrace wall. "It looks so sad in there, don't you think, Maz?" "I can't believe they just leave it sitting there empty like this. It's so wasteful," said Mariam, tapping grey powder onto Lara's eyelids. "You can see marks where they've taken away paintings and everything. It looks very neglected. Imagine what a great place it would be to have a party." "Yeah, you could really go wild. There's no one around for miles." "That looks great." Alex was admiring Lara's makeup. "I've set up the table and other props." Lara had to run across the terrace. They did several takes of this scene. They were using actual film, so every shot had to be right. She was very conscious of Alex's eyes on her. Classically handsome, Alex was quiet and she found him hard to read. As a result, she couldn't resist trying to attract his attention, something she wasn't used to having to do. Ethan discovered the old sundial on the terrace with its inscription, "Pulvis et umbra sumus," and decided to add it to the story. "What's that even mean?" Maz asked. "Sumus is we are, and I think umbra is shadows. I'm not sure about pulvis. Maybe dust? We are dust and shadows." "You understand it? You're posh." "Not posh. Just did Latin GCSE." Alex flushed. He hated being called posh because he got a scholarship to the local private school. Ethan asked Lara to read it. The shadow of the gnomon indicated it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They did several takes before Ethan was satisfied and the heat increased. The air felt as though it was vibrating around them. "I want to stop," begged Lara. "I need to do a few more," said Ethan. "By the lake, there's a little boathouse. I want to film you walking along the jetty." "I'm too hot." "It'll only take another 20 minutes. The light is perfect now." "Lara, can you change into that silver evening dress?" Lara sighed, then lifted the dress she was wearing over her head and waited in the sunshine, almost naked apart from a thong on her high heels. "Go on then, hand it over here," she said to Alex, who's trying to act nonchalantly and avoid staring at Lara's exposed flesh. Maz, also hot and tired, picked up the makeup bag and trudged behind Lara as she picked her way down to the boathouse by the lake. "This looks dangerous," announced Lara. She thumped on the jetty with her heels. Some of the wood was rotting. Ethan wasn't really listening. He was entranced by the contrast between the beautiful girl and the broken, faded jetty. Sunlight glinting on her dark hair and bringing out the sparkle on the evening dress. It would make a wonderful scene. He got the narrowed focus that happened when he was about to do something good. "Lara, I want you to start off on the grass and then walk slowly along to the end of the jetty." Lara turned and walked back onto the grass. Alex called, "Action!" and she began to walk along the jetty, the sequins on her dress dancing in the light. It was a long shot and Ethan trailed along behind her. A moment later, she stumbled sideways into the water. Ethan continued to film. "Do something!" yelled Maz at no one in particular. Alex hesitated for a moment, then pulled off his shirt and dived in. She could be hurt or have got caught on something. The water was quite deep here, he realised, but he could see that Lara was swimming up to the surface. She was spluttering something, treading water. "There's a body in the water! Oh my God! I saw it!" Alex swam with her to the bank, helping her climb out. She'd lost both her shoes and had to cling to him as they made their way back up the lake's muddy banks. They wrapped her in the picnic blanket and Maz rummaged in the cool box for something sugary. Slowly, colour started to return to her face. "I went under, and although it's weedy down there, I had my eyes open, and I swear I saw a body. A skeleton, I mean. Right under the jetty? I'm not sure. I think so." "Are you sure you didn't imagine it?" asked Ethan, frowning. "It's just that, you know, you had a shock." "I know I had a shock, but I'm not an idiot. It's just the light's so perfect. If we stop now... I think a dead body is a bit more important, don't you? Plus, I'm covered in mud and fucking pondweed, in case you haven't noticed. It looks great, with the hair and makeup. It actually really works. Let me do 20 minutes more, and then I swear we'll phone the police." "You're joking, aren't you, mate?" Alex had dived back in unnoticed to have a look around while the others were crowded around Lara. Now he returned to the group, water running off his body, toweling off his hair with his dry shirt. "I've seen it. It's definitely a human skeleton wrapped in something. It must have drifted under the jetty somehow, or it would have been found ages ago." Ethan looked at them both. "Compromise? I'll film both of you just as you are for 10 minutes and we'll call it a day. No, ring the police first and you can do it while we're waiting for them. It's probably aiding and abetting or something if you don't do that." In the end, that's what they did. Ethan continued filming Alex and Lara, both covered in pondweed and dripping wet. He got so engrossed that he wouldn't stop when the police arrived. The two constables who were first on the scene arrived via the driveway, after having forced access through the main gate, and walked around to the front lawns where they found the four young people in the grass by the jetty, two still in their bedraggled finery. They were not impressed. Those scenes ended up being the best footage that Ethan shot that day, though, he decided later, when he'd finally been released from the police station and had a chance to work on them. Lara and Alex entwined on the grass in the sunlight, water dripping from their hair, and behind them, death lurking below the murky surface of the water.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. Great questions, Martin.
Good answers.